The topic of our Dhamma this evening is Satna Effort Virya Part 1. And Satna later on in the week, Satna Part 2 will hopefully follow. Now, by way of an introduction to this Satna topic, allow me to begin with an illustration. Let us say you are the owner of a house and you're living in a beautiful house that is located right on the bank of a rather extensive or expansive lake, and behind and around your house is a deep forest. Deep forest, and it's somewhere here in the U.S. Now, and could be this time of the year, or it could be July. And it so happens that a big forest fire starts. Could be because of some natural reasons, could also be because of some negligence or whatever. Now, you live in this house, and very soon you realize that there is a massive forest fire in your backyard. You realize that you don't have much time. There is no chance to get into your car and drive away because the access road is already affected by the fire. So, what do you do? You jump into the lake. Yes, Satna Joanna, that's indeed what you might Satna do. But since your lake is pretty expansive, you might realize, well, swimming all across, I might not Satna manage to do this. And you remember that Satna you have a float or a raft as somewhere. So you grab that and Satna then you indeed jump into your lake. So you get onto the raft, and the forest fire is unrelenting. It's getting closer and closer to your house. The heat wave is just unimaginable, and you have only one idea in your mind, namely,
get to the other side.
By me.
Get to the other side.
To the other side, to get out of the, get away from it as quickly as possible. So you lie on your raft, you've got two hands, you've got two legs, and what do you do? You paddle as much as you can. You paddle for your life. And so, since the forest fire is still not suddenly giving in, and the heat wave can be felt even to the at least the middle of the lake, you might suddenly want to paddle quite a bit, and you might want to use which mental factor, or you might want to have which mental factor? Effort. There you go. And plenty of it. And since the forest fire is so huge and the heat of it is tremendous, there's only one possibility. Your effort has to be sustained. It has to be continuous. Now, this illustration might give you a general sense of what effort is all about. It's this energy that we put into an activity, namely going, in the case of our illustration, moving away from the shore that is beset by a danger, namely in the form of the fire, and then as quickly as possible you want to get to the other shore, which is safe and free from danger. Now, our meditation practice has anything to do with this illustration or not? Does it? Yes? No? A lot, even. So, you can think of yourselves as Satna lying on that raft and paddling with full force, trying to get away from this dangerous Satna shore and trying to reach the other shore. Now, in this Satna illustration, the raft Satna could be understood to be nothing other than the Dhamma. There you go, that is correct. Now, what we shall do is, in the course of this Dhamma talk, first Dhamma talk on effort, first look at its etymology, or the etymology involved, and then briefly mention a few other similes that the Buddha has used, and then say something about Satna, the qualities, the nature of Satna effort, then look at Satna, at least two definitions of Satna effort, and Satna, this will be followed by a brief exploration of Satna, the mental factor of Virya in the context of Satna, the Abhidhamma, then how when and where does effort occur in our meditation practice will also be explored, and certainly then some examples of effort as certainly given in the text will be briefly mentioned, and certainly then a few words certainly will come or towards the end, about balancing of effort. Now, the Pali term virya is certainly closely related to the Sanskrit word virya with a long I. And in Sanskrit, in the Vedic tradition, the term virya is oftentimes associated with heroism, and satna then with virility. If we look at satna, the Pali term virya, this satna then is related to the Pali word vira, which means satna, hero. Now, the literal translation of this satna term virya is a state of a strong man or manliness. Obviously, this satna should satna be, this term manliness should be adjusted according to gender. Now, Buddhaghosa has satna defined it as a state of an energetic person and also as the action of satna, the energetic. The terms that are usually related to effort will be explained in a little while. Before doing this, allow me to give you some of the imagery that Satna the Buddha has certain used to bring about Satna the nature of Satna Virya effort. There is in one discourse, effort is compared to the wheel of chariot or to a beast of burden that moves towards security from bondage without turning back. And probably this beast of burden will then run as fast as it can. Now, there is a discourse in the text entitled in English as discourse on the thoroughbred, the so-called Ajaniya Sutta, and there effort is compared to one out of four qualities of a thoroughbred, namely that of strength. And certainly here, then, that strength stands for strength of character. Now, the main aspects, and there are other aspects with regard to effort, is satna really its function of then moving exerting effort and satna then moving away from the cycle of birth and satna death towards a state of liberation. As can be seen from this already, this kind of satna effort is of a very particular nature. It is certain, it occurs in particular in connection with spiritual practice. Now, the Dhammasangani is an Abhidhamma work, and it's certainly very useful to consult when it comes to various or definitions of main Abhidhamma terms. And so the Dhammasangani usually defines by way of synonyms, by way of words that the Buddha has used with regard to effort or mindfulness or whatever the term might be. So the Buddha has spoken about effort on many occasions. This is recorded in many different places, and according to circumstances, he would use somewhat different language. So effort, has the Buddha has spoken of it as mental endeavor, cetasiko Virya Arambo in the Pali scriptural language. Also as riddance of getting rid of lethargy. And in Pali we have the word Parakama, which translates as satna, trying harder and satna harder, which is an aspect of effort that satna definitely will apply to our meditation practice. Now, in our mindfulness practice, we don't, if we get, let's say, to a particular place in the practice where it feels quite rewarding, feels quite pleasant, then we should not rest contented with this, but rather go on and thus endeavor higher and higher forms of intuitive knowledge. This in Pali is known as niyamo. Now, steadfastness, resoluteness, unfaltering endeavor, utmost exertion, not relinquishing the task, desire, a sustained desire to strive, then discharging the task well, all of these and other terms are or have been used by the Buddha to express this or that aspect of effort. Now, the Visuddhimagga, the path of purification that was compiled by Acharya Buddhadasa, gives Satna the following fourfold classical definition, and he says that the characteristic of mindfulness is supporting exertion and marshalling. The Venerable Sadhu Pandita Biwams of Burma puts it in the following words, namely, forbearance in the face of suffering or difficulty. Now, when we do Vipassana practice, it's not always certainly easy. There are tight spots along the way. There are times when we have to deal with some predominant pain. We have to deal with some difficult mental states. And so when having to face, let us say, an intense pain over a longer period of time, and then at first the mind might be able to do this and to continue to observe and know this the qualities of this particular object, but sooner or later the mind is likely to wither, so it loses its mental strength. And it is in this certain particular situation that then effort is certainly required, and its function is to support the associated mental states so that one then can continue to observe the respective object of observation. So in the absence of a boost of effort, the mind is likely, the observing and knowing mind is likely to collapse. In the presence of effort, however, this situation gets turned around, and thus the manifestation of effort is traditionally given as non-collapse of the mind. And so, the proximate causes for the arising of effort comes in the form of a sense of urgency or any ground for the arousing of energy. And during our second talk on effort, much emphasis will be placed on the development of effort. So once effort has arisen, how do we how do we bring about effort, and how do we strengthen it? Now, terms, modern terms that have been suggested for effort are energy, exertion, and satya, also persistence, persevering, being persevering, vigor, and satya, as well as satya, courage. Now, if we try to find a definition of our own, then effort is the, or virya is the exertion of energy, exertion of effort in the course of one's satna spiritual practice to move from a state of defilement of mind towards a state of purification of mind and to a state of liberation. And in doing so, paying much attention to the balance of, or ensuring the balance of effort, and this then requiring wise attention. Now, when we look at certain effort, certain, the mental factor of effort as certain one of the factors that the Abhidhamma describes, then we might immediately notice an interesting aspect. Without much understanding of the Abhidhamma, one might think of effort that this mental factor is a wholesome mental factor. But, at least from a Theravada point of view, it is not. But rather, it is categorized as one of the six occasionals, the so-called pakinakas. Occasionals in the sense of ethically variable mental states. So what this means is that a mental state, and virya being one of them, could at times be of an ethically wholesome quality, at other times could also be ethically unwholesome, depending on the consciousness that it arises with, as well as certainly the remaining mental factors. So the Pali, or effort, if we look at it from an Abhidhamma point of view, could be of a wholesome quality, could also be of an unwholesome quality. Now, if you think of a burglar who is intent on breaking into some posh mansion, will need what? Effort. Will need effort, namely to climb across the boundary wall, might need effort to climb onto the roof of the house, and suddenly then might need effort to climb through an open window in the roof into the house, and then to grab whatever seems valuable and interesting. But the effort that we are involved with is of the same nature, is of the nature of a burglar trying to grab as many things, steal as many things as possible? Obviously not. Therefore, it becomes clear that effort, depending on circumstances, and as mentioned depending on state of consciousness, could be wholesome at times, could be unwholesome. The effort, for the most part, that we are concerned with is a wholesome type of effort if it is directed towards liberation. However, if we sit in meditation and our mind then engages in plotting, let's say, some crimes after retreat, the retreat is over, I would say this is clearly not an unwholesome, this is clearly an unwholesome form of effort. Now, effort does arise together with consciousness that is rooted in greed, hatred, and delusion, and also together with sense sphere, wholesome sense sphere, resultant and sense sphere functional consciousness, as well as all of the jhanas and the four path knowledges and fruition knowledges. Now, in connection with Abhidhamma, but also from a very experiential meditational point of view, it's worth looking at its qualities, what actually it does in the practice. Now, the Venerable Sadhu Pandita Biwams of Burma explains that effort, for the most part, distances the mental defilements. It blocks unwholesomeness. It keeps them away. Now, different from this, when it comes to mindfulness, it faces an object of observation, and certainly in particular with regard to unwholesome mental states, it protects certainly the mind from those unwholesome states. Now, when it comes to concentration in samadhi, it has, or it is known, both in our practice as well as certainly in the text, to suppress certainly the hindrances. Now, how then do we experience effort in our own meditation practice? Namely, as patient endurance of difficulties such as itches that might arise, such as restlessness, various movements of the body. We try to sit still, but we can't. So to endure those impulses to move, then sticking out certain various pains, unpleasant sensations such as hardness, pressure, heat in the buttocks or stiffness in the back, then patiently enduring the consequence or the impact of the hindrances, such as, or in the form of exhaustion, of sloth and torpor, of restlessness, and then having practiced quite a bit and developed one's meditation to a high level of insight, knowledge, and Satna then, unfortunately, owing to some lack of or a lapse in mindfulness, then one's practice collapses. And one has to build it up all over again. And it may take even several days. And then, having done so, finally getting back to where one's practice was at earlier on, after maybe a couple of hours, again one is not suddenly really diligent, and suddenly once again a lapse in one's mindfulness occurs, and one's practice collapses for a second time. It takes much effort, it takes patient endurance to put up with this habit or pattern of the mind and pattern in our practice. Now, it also takes patient endurance in trying to find just the right balance in terms of effort. So, to ensure that one's satna effort is neither excessive nor deficient. And at times, satna, our effort will be excessive, and satna then will have to deal with the results of satna this, and at other times, the effort will be lacking, and satna this then might lead to sloth and satna torpor. So in both cases, we'll realize that this doesn't work. Now, even though we may have the greatest intention at the beginning of our sitting to keep the mind alert and awake, yet it does not necessarily happen like this. And we might find ourselves falling into a state of semi-consciousness. And once we're in that state, we might be stuck in it for a minute or two or even longer. And trying to get out of it isn't all that easy. So when this eventually, that semi-conscious state will subside, and suddenly then our mental alertness will regain that mental alertness, yet sooner or later we might drop into that same semi-conscious state again. And so if this happens many times, it clearly requires patient endurance. Just patiently enduring with all these different patterns that lie or that suddenly come up in the course of our meditation. Now, when it comes to straightforward sloth and torpor, it's certainly the same thing. It's not a pleasant state certainly to be in, and certainly to deal with effort that is approaching is not necessarily pleasant. And so this satna then requires much satna patient endurance. Now, with regard to satna to our sitting posture, at times we might satna find that even though the intention is there to keep the body as upright as possible, yet what really happens in the practice might be a different thing. And suddenly we might suddenly find how we might find suddenly the body slumping, and suddenly this then requires suddenly an adjustment of the posture, and then soon again the body will slump, and again we need to adjust, and this may happen many times. Now, it's not only that satna effort is required with regard to difficult experiences, but effort might also be experienced as a real strength. Namely, at certain points in our practice, we might notice a real increase in energy. We have more energy available, and more so than before, and then we find to sit for an hour is no big problem, and easily we can extend our sitting to an hour and a half, or 2 hours, or much more than this. We might further find that towards the end of the last sitting of the day, we still have plenty of energy left. Everyone else goes back to the room, and we can't even, or don't even want to think about sleeping, and then simply continue to practice sitting, walking, sitting, walking. Now, we might further find that despite of having practiced deep into or late into the night, and yet at next morning we wake up at the usual time, and the mind is quite refreshed, and the body well rested. So these are some of the ways how we might experience effort in our practice. Effort that is needed with regard to overcoming difficult experiences, as well and with regard to those patient endurances that needed, and for the other cases we just our effort will do its work. Before talking about certain more general aspects related to effort, allow me to continue to mention aspects that are directly related to our meditation practice. Now, we have the Satipatthana Sutta, the Discourse on the Establishment of Mindfulness, and does it contain anything on effort? Is there any instruction there or not?
Just the word arta.
Ah, there you go. Indeed, the word arta, be ardent energy or ardent effort. You might recall here, a retreatant dwells, contemplating the body in the body, ardent, clearly comprehending, having removed covetousness and discontent in regard to the world. So, this certain word, atapi, obviously is not the same as virya, yet in terms of its essence, both are equal. Both are pretty much the same. Now, the Satipatthana Sutta clearly states that in doing mindfulness practice, we do need mindfulness. However, this mindfulness needs to be accompanied by other factors such as clear comprehension, as well as satna, by ardent energy. And it goes without saying that this satna, ardent satna energy, then needs to be of a well-balanced satna nature. Now, the Pali term atapa, which is the noun for ardent energy, can be traced back to the noun tapash in Sanskrit, and this meaning self-mortification and ascetic practices. However, the Buddha's idea of ātāpa was not quite the same. Was for sure not indulging in self-mortification or anything related to it. But rather an ardent energy that is directed at burning up and consuming the mental defilements as they arise in the stream of consciousness. The Visuddhimagga explains this particular aspect explains ātāpi as possessing energy in the sense of an energy that satna is directed towards satna, the burning up and the consuming of mental defilements. Now, at the time of the Buddha, as well as until today, there were plenty of ascetics in the Vedic tradition who are of the opinion that engaging in practices of asceticism, of self-mortification, is the way to liberation. And such ascetics typically would maybe stay really close to a burning fire, or would then stand up for, or remain in a standing posture for many hours, stop, or it might be sleeping on glass satna shirts, or walking across satna glass shirts, and walking around satna naked, dipping in and staying in ice cold satna water over long periods of time, and hanging themselves up from the branch of a tree. Revolving in Lumbini, we've seen someone who, in an upright posture, keeps revolving, keeps turning his body around and around and around and around thousands of times in a day and day after day. It's considered as a form of spiritual practice. So, the Buddha himself engaged, did engage, or the Bodhisatta, to be more precise, did engage in ascetic practices. He did eat very little, go without sleep and the like, and eventually he realized that this path was not fruitful. It did not lead him to liberation, and eventually he did what? He gave up on it. He gave up on it and realizing that more important than these ascetic practices is effort with regard to mental development and keeping the mind free from mental defilements. So he then characterized this, or defined this, as a true form of ardent energy or effort. Which obviously is quite different from the Vedic notion. Now, in our meditation practice, we will be experiencing effort throughout, and we also need to exert effort, and the various aspects of effort have been described in different ways. Now, in the end, they all boil down to one and the same thing, namely effort. But one of these categories is as follows, namely an initial effort that is required to get started or to get established in one's practice, and this is known as arambha dhatu in the Pali scriptural language. So the effort that it takes to make arrangements at home for a retreat, to make arrangements at the workplace to get off work, and then travel arrangements, then to make the effort to actually reach the retreat location, and then to settle in to hear the meditation instructions, and then to get started in one's practice. Now, that's your initial type of effort. However, this much of effort, and this effort will still be relatively weak, will not be sufficient, will not be strong enough to realize the Dhamma. So, as one continues to practice, one will sooner or later come across the hindrances. You're all familiar with those by now, and those hindrances need to be overcome, and this requires effort, namely a so-called stepped up or boosted form of effort, nikama dhatu in the Pali scriptural language. So if you boost your effort in the face of the hindrances, then you'll be able to overcome them sooner or later. And with this, your practice will then keep moving ahead. And what is then needed is, as a third form of effort, the so-called culminating effort, in the Pali scriptural language given as Parakrama Dhatu. And this is the effort that keeps increasing and ultimately leads to the realization of the Dhamma. So this is one way of describing the gradual strengthening of effort. Now, in the course of our meditation practice, we may come across an effort in a very direct manner at different points. So the overcoming of the hindrances is one such point. And then at a later point in practice, we are likely to experience what is known as the imperfections of insight. And the term is somewhat misleading. Qualities such as illumination, obasa, keen and unerring knowledge is another one, and then joy is yet another one. Joy, tranquility, happiness, faith, and determined faith, and then followed by effort, bhagaha in the Pali scriptural language. These and other mental factors are known as imperfections, or are imperfections only, if one gets attached to them, or based on them, pride and conceit develops, or one holds to the wrong view, that Nibbana has been attained already. Anyways, when one reaches this certain phase in one's meditation practice where the imperfections come to the foreground of one's certain meditation, then one is likely sooner or later to notice an increase in one's certain energy. So one has more energy available. And it is certain then that, as described earlier on, one finds it no longer difficult to sit for an hour and a half or even 2 hours. So without straining, one can easily sit for an extended period of time. And not wanting to open the eyes, not wanting to look around, and sadness, sometimes retreatants at such a point in the practice might even decide to forego a meal or two, because the practice is just sadness so rewarding. Now, a retreatant at this point in the practice might also experience much energy until late into the night. Some retreatants have so much energy that they might go through and into practicing through an entire night without lying down and without sleeping. So just sitting, walking, sitting, walking. Now, at this point in the practice, the energy comes naturally, and it's not so, in the end, it's not so difficult continue practicing through the night. But at other points in the practice, conditions are not necessarily the same, and if one then were to force it and force oneself to practice throughout the entire night, maybe assuming the full lotus posture and changing one's posture until dawn of the next morning has come, well, that would be forcing things a bit too much. And that's not certain balanced effort for sure. So when one experiences this kind of an effort bhagaha in Pali, it's important not to get attached to it, not to become proud and conceited. Now, when one continues with one's certain meditation practice, one is likely to experience a number of rather rewarding physical and mental formations. Various insight knowledges will be traversed, and sooner or later, some difficult physical and mental states will come up, and a retreatant might find himself or herself having to face the so-called dukkha jnanas. So the insight knowledges of dukkha, of suffering. Now, at times, the dukkha can be so massive in one's sadhana walking meditation that one barely has the strength to do another or to take another step. And in this kind of a situation, effort is clearly required. So the effort made to take one more step, and one more step, and still one more step. At that point, your legs might feel very heavy, as if you have a weight of or some metal attached to your legs. Now, having dealt with a number of difficulties that are clearly practice related, having overcome those and being desirous of escaping this whole range of unsatisfactory bodily and mental formations, one that might be quite eager to realize the Dhamma. And at that point, a rather specific experience occurs, and this can be checked in interviews as Satna retreat and Satna report, and there's also some evidence for this in the text itself, namely in the Kitagiri Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, that speaks of a certain determination, a very strong determination that arises, namely, whatever it might take for me to realize the Dhamma, that I will do. And even if my blood in the body dries up and only bones and sinews and the like remain, nonetheless, I will continue. It's a longer statement. I'm shortening it. Now, so that particular passage from the Kitagiri Sutta very much coincides with what actually happens in the meditation practice at a very particular place in one's sutta meditation. Now, to balance out certain things, and this is important, obviously, please don't, you don't have to think that you need to practice with that kind of determination, that you sit until, or even if you lose much of your weight and your blood starts drying up and so on and so forth. If you manage to practice with, let's say, 40 or 50% of this sutta determination, is still pretty good. So balance, please hear this, balance of effort is important. Now, at this particular point in our meditation practice, the effort tends to be somewhat unbalanced, and at times in excess, at times deficient. And so what is required of a retreatant is to get the effort right, and that is done by way of trial and error. So at times one might overdo it and realize this is not working. With too much effort, one gets restless. Too little effort, one falls asleep. And gradually, the mind will then find just the right amount of effort. And as one's meditation then continues, one's effort will come naturally. Retreat, not only this, but energy seems to be flowing, seems to become accessible, and with this, then the effort becomes effortless effort. Obviously, retreatants very much like that kind of effort. At that point, the sitting posture will naturally be upright and relaxed and still. You no longer have difficulties to sit upright and still. Now, since, as usual, we're already somewhat advanced in time, and there's still more events could and should be mentioned, I'll keep that for the next Dhamma talk on effort, namely part 2, and allow me to conclude today's Satna Dhamma talk by wishing may, in the course of your meditation practice, may you discover for yourselves what effort is, what its nature is, and then where and how to use this effort skillfully, and may you keep paddling on your makeshift raft from moving away from mental defilements, and ultimately may you reach the safe shore of the liberation from all mental defilements. And this is it for today. Yes, okay. So, let's hear, Jim.
The question relates to the intelligence in the effort.
Mm-hmm.
I've always regarded Vipassana practice as when it's cultivated as a path to direct knowledge and understanding of the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I'm listening through your discussion of where he is here. For the intelligence in the effort that could lead the meditator to that direct understanding. So let me just give you a sort of simple example here. Supposing during the course of my practice, greed arises, craving for food. I want more food. More food than I need. If my effort is directed at burning up and consuming the greed, sure enough, my mind is no longer afflicted by it. But I will also have lost the opportunity to see what drives that greed. So for example, just as an example, maybe that greed for food is driven by a fear of starvation, which I've inherited, let's say, from my parents, who may have lived through poverty. I will never know that if I burn up the greed at that moment, so it never arises again. The understanding is, it seems to me, so much more important than eliminating in the moment the greed. It's standing in front of the greed long enough to understand what its origins are, it seems to me, is more important.
Mm-hmm. You know. See, it's not a matter of eliminating that greed for food. Once and with that, it's gone forever. Greed is a mental state that will be sticking around for quite some time. And you'll have plenty of occasions to look at this certain greed for food, which is motivated by your parents having experienced great starvation. And so there will be plenty of those occasions coming up, and occasions when prior or let's say in the course of a meal, one loses one's mindfulness, and then this greed comes up. Eventually, one recognizes to be mindful. One recognizes that one is no longer mindful, and then one can look at this greed for food. And so, the continuity of mindfulness. That's. In order to assure the continuity of mindfulness, we need the effort. No, so I don't think that in actual practice that we deprive ourselves of clearly getting to see the nature of greed for food, because it will come up again and again.
Well. It just seems to me that it's more than push-pull, that there's a kind of there's a quality that's required in the effort. More intelligence is required so that I can understand clearly what the origins are of this hindrance that's in front of my mind at this moment.
Mm.
But if my effort is entirely to eliminate it, then... It seems to me I've lost the opportunity.
It's, Jim, mindfulness practice is for sure a gradual path. And so a path of gradual development, it's not that things are happening in an abrupt manner. And so in the course of our meditation and practice, this greed will come up on many occasions, and we'll take a closer look at it. It disappears temporarily. We abandon it temporarily, and suddenly it's gone for a while. And sooner or later, when the next delicious meal comes, the greed is back, and you'll have another chance to look at it. And with other mental factors, mental defilements, it's the same thing. It would be nice if it would take maybe just one moment of intense looking at ignorance, and then all of the ignorance is gone once and forever. That would be nice, but that's not the way it happens.
Thank you.
Even the Buddha had to work really hard to eradicate ignorance and all of the other hindrances.
Yeah, and I think you're suggesting he had lifetimes of development.
That's included.
Not just the 6 years.
Yeah, not only those 6 years, as SETI practices and followed by mindfulness practice, but also during previous existences. No. Any other questions? Yes, Wynne?
Just a brief question. I've always liked the word ardor in Sati. It has a particular heartful flavor to me, and I'm wondering if in your translation of that word you didn't suggest that ardor is different than effort. I think in what I understood what you just said, and I'm just wondering if it has a just ardent, the basis ardor.
Yeah, same, mm-hmm. Same in that sense, and so, but different from the ardor. In terms of, don't you use the word ardor, or also when one falls in love with someone, and then there's.
Yes.
One is what, ardently in love with someone, or yeah, you say like this, okay, and so it's not that kind of meaning, of course. No, there is there's a certain degree of being passionate about something, but it's not the matter of falling in love, but falling in love with the rise and fall and other predominant objects of observation. No. So I would, just like you're saying, taking ardor and then effort, energy, and perseverance, etc., to be synonymous terms. No, so if ardor works for you, then use that term. The Buddha has indeed, atapa means ardor, or ardent effort, ardent energy. It's being translated in slightly different ways. Yes, Venerable Dhammadina.
Atapi is related to tapas, which at the same time we get in English as tepid. It's all related to heat. So it's like tapasya is an ardent burning.
There you go.
Just walking in.
Yeah, that's good point. No, and that's probably why the Buddha used that word, atapa, atapi. No, because there is that notion of burning in it, but not sitting close to a fire, but rather the burning up of the mental defilements. No. Any other questions? If not, then that's all for tonight.